You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Gotta say that, it's summer. Always going to be bright, beautiful, and sunny.
And clear, although it's funny, last week we talked about clear and cloudless, and then monsoon air passed over us. And for a brief period on Thursday, it was overcast here in the Sacramento Valley. So it was not completely cloudless. Monsoon air pushing way up here over from the southwest. There were some thunderstorms and things like that on the other side of the valley. And a few people reported little droplets falling out of the sky here and there. And when at sunset, we had a lovely rainbow here last Thursday. Nothing like that in the imminent forecast. Today's date is August 7, 2024 for broadcast on August 8, 2024. Today, as Lois and I are recording the show, the high is going to be 100 degrees. Tonight will be mostly clear and 60 degrees. Thursday will be 97. And I had a very amusing conversation with a customer where we're cheering because it's only going to be 97. That tells you something about the climate in which we live. Thursday night will be clear and 59 degrees. Friday, 96 degrees. Friday night, 58 degrees. I like this trend. Saturday, 95 degrees. Saturday night, 59 degrees. Sunday, 90 degrees. That sounds lovely for everything we've been through for the last few weeks. Sunday night, 58. Monday, 89. Monday night, 58. Tuesday, 87. Okay, gardeners, you can get back out there and do stuff. We're going to have something resembling fairly normal weather. And actually, look at this. Three of those days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, that's below our average high temperature for this time of year. So
in order to have an average, you have to have some things that are below it. Otherwise, you couldn't have that as an average. And we've been having a lot of ones that are higher. But you know, what I want to point out is that on my little weather app on the phone, we're talking about different models and things like that. So on my phone, it's different. The high is higher, it's 103. Mm. Then we've got 3 days in the upper to mid 90s, and then 3 days in the 80s, and then back up to the 90s for a couple of days, and back down to the 80s. So it's wonderful.
That's normal. What used to be normal. So our average high temperature this time of year, for those of you outside this area, 92 to 93 degrees, our average high July and early August. And throughout the entire month of July, we had no days that I can remember below 92 or 93. So the entire month was above average, and we broke a bunch of records during, you know, National Weather Service keeps putting out these cool graphics showing us how many days it was and blah, blah, blah. For the next week or so, not only is it going to be cooler, so it'll be comfortable for all of us, it's going to be great pollination weather for tomatoes. So if you have tomato plants and you've given them a good deep watering and they're growing vigorously and they're flowering, they're setting fruit. They're beginning to set fruit for the next major crop, which is my big one, the ones that'll be ripening. Remember, this data point I got from a farmer over in Cape Valley years ago, she said it's 49 days from fruit set to harvest for early girl tomato. 49 days, 7 weeks, which is a very useful data point. It's less than that for cherry tomatoes and some of the sauce tomatoes. It's more than that for really large fruited tomatoes, but she used early girl, 4 to 6 ounce fruit, 49 days. This is a farmer, so she needed to know exactly how when the harvest is going to be. And I have found that it's very, very useful data point because 7 weeks from now, okay, that's late September when it's still plenty warm here, plenty summer-like here, plenty of tomato ripening weather. We actually get that kind of weather all the way into the middle of October. So you can get a very big crop of tomatoes coming if you deep water your plants and they're still growing vigorously and blooming.
So 49 days from fruit set to harvest, but does all the fruit get set at the same time?
Nope. You have a sequence. You can watch, if you have the right kind of cage or training structure, you can watch exactly what's happening. Most of my tomatoes are in 5.5 foot cages. All of them have reached the top of those cages. Several of them are well out the top of those cages and are beginning their late summer mode of cascading back down to the ground. This is why I space my tomato plants several feet apart. So now I'll be able to walk around this whole weeping fountain of tomatoness and pick the fruit from the outside of the cage. Those are the ones that are beginning to set now, and they can continue to set here all the way in through September with no problem. Even those will have a chance to ripen because they will ripen in early November, and very commonly here we still have suitable weather for ripening then, or you can pick and bring them in. So I always want to emphasize that the late crop is often much bigger than the early crop on tomatoes here. Main point being, we're going into a period now, a week or more, where we should have very good pollination. If your plant is very drought stressed because you haven't been watering deeply, if it's not growing well, not growing vigorously, you'll miss out on that harvest. I've talked to more than one person at this point who has just harvested everything they want, canned them, frozen them, put them away, and are pulling out their plants. All right, that's fine. If you're done, that's great. You now have room for Brussels sprouts and rutabagas and all that kind of thing. But we are at the beginning of the development, you know, the set and development of the major crop, for many of us anyway, the late summer and early fall crop. And the weather is cooperating. Our traditional August cool down. Can't remember which Sacramento weather personality used that term originally. Might have been Mark Finan. It's talking about the August cool down. And as many years as I've been here, almost every August, we have a week to 10 days of cooler weather. And that is really crucial to that late harvest of tomatoes. So if you've been watering with a drip system that comes on lightly every day and the plants are struggling a little bit, right now would be a really good time to give each plant a few gallons of water. All at once. You don't have to do that by any means every day, but all at once right now, and get some more growth going on there. You should be able to get a whole another late summer, early fall crop of tomatoes.
Hey, Don, did you know that there is a huge colony of migratory bats that live under the Yolo Causeway during the summer?
I knew that, and it's wonderful. They are very, very voracious insect eaters. And you out there listening can join Yolo Basin Foundation for a summertime bat talk and tour to learn all about these amazing and beneficial mammals. By the way, they're all over the place. If you're out right at dusk, you may see them flying around. They used to live in our garage, and you'd see them zooming out of the garage right at twilight. Well, you can watch a couple hundred thousand of them do that following a presentation on bat natural history, where you will have the opportunity to see live ambassador bats up close. The group, which can include you, will caravan out to the Yolo Bypass Wildlife Area for a brief tour of the wetlands and rice fields. Then you get in position to watch the flyout of the largest urban colony of Mexican free-tailed bats in California. They emerge in long ribbons as they head out to hunt for insects for the night, and the whole experience takes about 3 hours. This is a family-friendly event. There's a small amount of walking. Those in wheelchairs or who are unable to walk may view the bats by car. Bat talk and tour events begin in late June and run through September. There is a fee. In regards to the heat, they want you to know, well, it can be very hot in town during the heat of the day. The first hour and a half of the program is in an air-conditioned room. And then from your own vehicle, you can do the auto tour. And by the time you're outside to view the flyout, it will be nearly sunset, typically 10 to 15 degrees cooler in the Yolo Bypass Wildlife Area where we watch the bat fly out. That goes on all summer long. But there's a special event I wanted to mention, Bats and Crafts. This Saturday, August 10th, 10 a.m. to noon, where else can you meet live bats, dress up like a bat, and do crafts all morning? Well, kids will also explore the ponds and wetlands while learning about these amazing flying mammals. This event is aimed at 3 to 8-year-old children, is a favorite amongst both kids and parents. So for that particular event, August 10, you will go to yolobasin.org and register for it, and you'll find information about the regular evening bat tours as well. Quick, Lois, what is the Yolo Basin Foundation?
Oh, that's an organization that is interested in educating people about wetlands, They are based here in Davis, and the Yolo Basin is what we call the stuff on
Bypass.
the causeway. What do you call it?
The Yolo Bypass.
Bypass, yeah. And if you look at the sign, it says the Vic Fazio wetlands. So anyway, it's on Childs Road is the headquarters building, and they've got a map on the website, so.
I got to explain to someone why we called it the Yolo Bypass, and that's because it's a flood bypass system. It takes the Sacramento River and makes it bypass the city of Sacramento, which used to
When
run, which would flood routinely in the past. So we have a very elaborate system here for taking that excess water under certain conditions. Just within the last few years, this has happened a couple of times. They open all the weirs, which are holding the water back, and they drain the water out into the Yolo Bypass onto farmland. It's farmland during the summertime. In a wet winter, it looks like an inland sea as you drive across on the causeway. So I had to explain what the causeway was and what a bypass was. The causeway is the highway that goes over the bypass. The Yolo Basin Foundation is under the highway in the
Almost done, almost done.
bypass. Almost.
The causeway is the bridge that goes over the bypass. It happens to have a freeway system on it because I-80 goes there. But even if it didn't, if like the causeway, there's a railroad causeway because there's a bridge where the railroad tracks go. And then the Yolo Basin Foundation organization is not underneath there. No, their housing is on Childs Road, up the road a little ways, probably about half a mile up the road, and that's where the headquarters building is. That's where all the fish and game headquarters building is, and all that stuff. And they have educational material there. They have a little museum. That's where the talks are given. It's a wonderful place. The whole thing, a wonderful place.
I'm told by birders it's a great place to go. Just
Oh,
walking
yeah.
around, you'll see all kinds of birds and other wildlife out there. Who knows? So you can go out there at other times, but they have all these great events out there. Bat events continue on through in through part of September. This is an amazing population. I know many people are squeamish about bats. You don't have to interact with them directly. They're way up there in the sky, and they eat a lot of insects. They're very, very, very beneficial.
On my radio show, which is called That's Life, and it's on the same radio station that you're listening to right now, I interviewed the Bat Lady several times. So if you go and look for my show and search for the word bats, you'll find I think three interviews with Corky.
So, three episodes of Bat's Life on KDRT. Okay, there's some other great programming here at KDRT, and we have several new programmers, and this is always very exciting. So, I like to mention the new shows, and there's one that just started, first episode, August 1, Grist for the Chill. Dave serves up a truly interesting mix of music with a focus on fingerstyle guitar and percussive groove as it relates to roots, world fusion, jazz, funk, Latin and Brazilian music, and more. So, programmer Dave has started a brand new show here at KDRT, Grist for the Chill, presently running Thursdays, 10 to 11 a.m. Probably will rotate in on repeat at some point. So, for the rebroadcast time for all the great programming here at KDRT, just click on the schedule guide.
Well, I am going to update you on the chip saga for Lois. Absolutely nothing happened. And that's because this past weekend was the first Friday of the month. And that means that Friday, Saturday, Sunday was the book sale for the Friends of the Library, Friends of the Davis Library. And the fellow who helps me in the yard works that sale, help set it up, get it ready, get it going. And so we haven't done anything for the week. But next month, you all can go and volunteer to help set up the library books. I'll tell you more about it some other meeting.
Well,
Okay.
the chip question has come up. A couple other people have asked me about chip drop and how it works and all that kind of thing. This is a good overview. You got a lot of chips all at once.
Oh yeah, I'm going to have to put a sign out that says "Got chips? Inquire within."
Well,
And
someone already asked me if you had extras, so I will we'll figure that out. But it's a lot of material. And someone else asked me, do you need to water them? And I said, well, no, you don't need to water them. They're wet. These are trees that were ground up, at least mostly. So these were at one time living, and so they're not like bark or sawdust or something like that. They're ground things that were just cut down. So they have a lot of natural moisture. And what happens is that immediately, as soon as you put them on bare soil, if you happen to do that, worms and especially mycorrhizae invade rapidly from below, and they pull up moisture from below into these already moist wood chips. If you want to overhead water them, that would be great for lots of beneficial organisms in your yard. It's always a good idea to have some extra moisture out there for lace wings and, you know, leather wing beetles and lizards and foxes and who knows what might be in your backyard. But you don't need to because they're already moist, unlike some other products you might be thinking of spreading around your yard. We'll talk more about Lois's chips in upcoming events of the Chip Drop Saga here at KDRT.
Looking into the mail, and by the way, if you want to send us an email and talk to us about something or ask a question or give us compliments, that's okay too. Where do they send them now?
Why, they do it to davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
You know, that sounds an awful lot like davisgardenshow.com, which is where they can also find archives.
Yes, and you can also find all the archives at KDRT, KDRT.org.
So, Mary from, I don't know where Mary's from. Oh, Folsom, there we go. Hello, Don and Lois. I look forward to your show every week and learn something new each time. I planted a variety of tomatoes this year. The Brandy Boy plants have greatly disappointed. They have not had one set, though cool spells as well as heat spells. Do they have special needs? The best producer I have is Galahad tomato.
Okay, we'll start with that one. There's two questions, two part here. I'll make a note of Galahad because someone else mentioned this variety and I want to do that one for next year and see how it does for me. And that's what I do. And Brandy Boy is a really good example of this issue. The very first year, let's back up. Brandy Boy is one of the hybrid heirloom hybrids. All right, so they took heirloom tomato, Brandywine, and they crossed it with something like Better Boy. Better Boy is a whole established product line from originally Burpee Seed Company, and they came up with Brandy Boy. The idea being it had the disease resistance and the vigor and the productivity of the Better Boy and the flavor of the Brandywine. Now, if you're a longtime listener to the show, you know I always tell you, don't plant Brandywine. Brandywine doesn't set fruit above about 85 degrees, but Better Boy generally does set fine. The first year I grew Brandy Boy, probably 15 or 20 years ago, when it first came on the market, I got 30 fruit and each of them was over a pound. I thought, wow, okay, we're onto something here. This is amazing. I took pictures of them and it was great flavor and all that kind of thing. But I had already adopted my practice of not recommending a variety until I'd grown it for at least 2 years. And the next year I got zero. So my average for 2 years was 15.
But when you get zero, that wipes out everything else.
Yes. Every year I have one tomato that basically skunks me. I mean, like one or two fruit or even zero. And that year it was Brandy Boy. Looking back, because I was keeping track of temperature records, the year it didn't produce well was a hot year. We had a lot of days over 100. But the year it produced was a sort of an average year. And so it was a little surprising that I got zero. But that does happen. And so Brandy Boy, well, a wonderful variety, is not on my recommended list. I do sell it at times. And I want people to know, if you're buying five or six tomatoes, you want to grow this one, you get that year where you get 31-pound fruit and they have a wonderful flavor, great. But be aware that you might get a low production year. And so that's one of the reasons that, as I say, I always do at least 2 years test, and I don't write it off if I get zero. I'll try it again. But that's a bad start if you happen to have a year where you'd get nothing. It does appear to have some of the temperature sensitivity of Brandywine. No, it's not a special need. There's no fertilizer. It's just kind of bad luck. Good news is we've still got time. Even though it's a large fruited variety, there is still time, if it's growing and flowering, as we said at the outset of the program, for fruit to set and develop. And in the case of a larger fruited one like that, it's probably closer to 8 to 10 weeks from fruit set to pick. But that still puts you at the end of September, early October, anywhere in the Sacramento Valley, you still have plenty of time for it to fruit. So don't yank it out or anything like that. Unfortunately, it's just apparently the parentage of that particular variety. But when you get a good year, it's really worth it. And I've had these ups and downs with heirloom varieties. This year, pineapple, I've got six fruit. Each of them is at least a pound. They're going to be giant and beautiful, but six is not a lot of fruit to get on a tomato vine that you've put all this effort into. Last year, my pineapple variety, which is this wonderful, tangy flavored, beautiful fruited one, gave me 15 and they were all over a pound. So that I thought was pretty good. Cherokee Purple 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 80 fruit. This year looks like about 20. So heirlooms can be kind of capricious. They aren't absolutely, they're not reliable in terms of fruit production. Some are more reliable than others, but I do have this year, my skunk is Prudence Purple, which has one one fruit on a 7-foot vine. It better be good. There's a chance it'll produce some more, but I'm probably not going to rush to grow that one again at the rate things are going this year.
So, Don, I know that you said that the high temperatures will cause the tomato blossoms to not self-pollinate. And you can't go out and pollinate it for it. No, that doesn't work. So if that's the case, different varieties have different temperatures at which they fail. Is that true?
It seems to be, yes. I mean, I've been observing this for a long time and making notes about it. And you would expect that this was a really interesting year in that regard. People got very good pollination in May and June, which you may forget now were relatively mild. And so a lot of people got a really great early crop. The temperatures all through July were basically above what would have been suitable for pollination. So if a variety was actually setting during July, I've definitely made note of that. There's about five out there that I have that continued to set right through July. Well, the cherry tomato types, little saladette types, smaller fruited types seem to be more tolerant of high temperatures. Or maybe it's just that there's so many blossoms that even if only 10% of them are setting, you still get fruit. But I have noticed three of the Wild Boar Farms varieties, Brad Gates' introduction. He's a farmer in this area who has introduced this whole line of tomatoes over the last 20 years. Three of his have continued to set right through the heat. I mean, I was very surprised to see that, and a couple of others. So I'll give a more full report on this a little bit later in the month, but there are some that have shown greater tolerance of high temperatures. And over the years, I've observed Champion as an example of a hybrid that seems to continue to set at higher temperatures. Nothing's setting when it's 110. Very few are setting when it's 105. The question is, do they set when it's 98? Or 95. And a lot of tomatoes, it seems that 90, 91 degrees is pretty much the threshold for the flowers to self-pollinate. Above that, they just fail to pollinate and fall off. What happens apparently is that the pollen tubes fail to develop. It's not that the flower doesn't get tickled or anything like that. It's simply that the pollen is damaged by the temperature. And my understanding is in humid climates, the pollen becomes clumpy and doesn't develop properly. High temperatures above about 90 seem to reduce fruit set in most tomato varieties. It's above about 85 in the case of beefsteak and Brandywine. So we don't recommend those at all because it's a rare summer here when we're not above 85 most of the summer at the high temperature time of day.
Other than the fruit flower, or rather than the flowers failing.
Got it.
So other than the flowers failing to develop, failing to pollinate, is there anything else that would make the fruit not set? In other words, if you're not watering enough, or if you're watering too much, or is there anything other than just temperature that can affect the pollination and setting of fruit?
Yes, drought stress. And drought stress on the day that flower is open would probably cause it to wither. And I've observed that when they're not getting watered at all, or when the watering is causing significant stress between irrigations, and that happens in raised planters and containers, for example. When I've grown tomatoes in containers, if the container goes dry, those flowers don't set. You can also tell quickly because the plant is wilted, but they will not set when it's that stressed. So drought stress can certainly be a factor. And it seems to be a very important factor in the cell division stage. So even if pollination occurs, a lot of times the fruit won't develop properly because of severe drought stress. You would probably know if you had severe drought stress, but that could be a factor as well. But in the case of some varieties, it's just where they came from and what their genetic history is. And in the brand, you know, we know the Brandywine, which is wildly popular back east. It's probably the best known heirloom variety tomato from the Brandywine Valley of Pennsylvania. They get warm there, but I don't think they get to 100 plus, and I don't think their humidity is 12% when it happens. So it's just not a good variety for out here, and that parentage is a concern. And the same thing with beefsteak. Those two in particular are well-known, popular American tomatoes that are not great for the West Coast interior, shall we say.
You said, and you will know if your tomatoes aren't watered enough by looking at them, but the people who are having this problem are probably not as aware as you as to what to look for when some plant is drought stressed. Mm-hmm. So can you give lay people a clear description of if this happens, then you better up your water?
Well, the plant is a vine-like plant. It's really a ground cover, but we grow it as if it were a vine. And if the new growth is wilting, then it's not getting adequate moisture to sustain the new growth. The leaves will also cup or curl somewhat, which can happen with overwatering as well. But if it's under irrigated, that new vigorous new growth will just start drooping midday. Here's an important point. You really should check your garden every day. And I know a lot of people don't. So if you're not walking out there, and you know, you don't have to walk out at 3 in the afternoon when it's 112 degrees. I do that just to see what's going on, but scurry back inside as quickly as you can. But check every day. You know, our motto is check daily, water as needed. It doesn't mean you water daily, but if you don't go out there at least at, you know, 5:36 when you get home and see how things are doing, if they'll still be drooping at that point if it's a hot day, and you can bend down, check the soil moisture. That's really important, and especially for raised planters and containers, because when they dry out, you have no margin of error. You don't have any extra soil that those roots have found nearby. It's all confined in, you know, what you've provided them, and what you've provided them may not have as much available water as you think, because the kind of soil you filled it with may not retain moisture that well. So check your plants every day, water as needed, learn to recognize the symptoms of drought stress. Overwatering, which is honestly not that common with tomatoes, overwatering leads to really lush, vigorous plants. That's the typical problem. When you water a lot, you get these plants that grow like crazy, just like when you give a lot of nitrogen, and that seems to reduce overall yield. But I'm much less concerned about that these days than I am with underwatering, because so many people have gone to trickle drip systems that are barely putting out a little bit of water, and they're not running them long enough. That by far the most common conversations we have are, this isn't doing well. How are you watering? I'm running my drip system. How is it running 10 minutes a day? You know, that kind of thing. That's just not the way to do it for most plants, honestly, much less a deep-rooted vine-like plant like a tomato.
So I understand that even a healthy plant, when it's 105, is probably going to have its leaves drooped a little because it's trying to, you know, protect itself from the 105. Wouldn't it make sense to go out in the morning, you know, before breakfast with your cup of tea, your coffee, your orange juice, whatever it is, go out and just wander around your things and look at the plants then? Yes. Because they should not be drooping. And if they are drooping at that time, you've got a problem. And you look at the tips of the tomatoes and the tops of whatever plants you're growing, and if they're not doing well, you've got a problem.
I walk through my garden every morning, and I walk through when I get home, and I walk through closer to twilight. But I don't expect most people to do that. Okay.
You're gone. You're good.
Learn to poke in the soil and check the soil moisture. Check daily, water as needed. We're going to do a whole show of our little sayings at some point. That one's right up there at the top. We've got a t-shirt with that on it, thanks to one of our listeners. Okay, there's another part to this question. So
there's a second question from Mary Kay. It is about making and using compost tea. I regularly brew up a batch of aerated compost tea using compost from both my regular compost and worm bids, and adding molasses, bokashi bran, maxicrop granules, and full humix. I aerate using a weighted aquarium bubbler and a 5-gallon bucket of dechlorinated water, and I let it bubble for 3 days. I use it as a foliar spray. Is this compost tea really useful, or is it just a fun backyard science experiment? It's to help my peach and nectarine trees recuperate from peach leaf curl. Thanks very much for sharing your expertise.
I do not think there is any point in making compost tea. I do not think that there's evidence that compost tea sprayed on plants makes a significant difference. Our old friend, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, who's an associate professor and extension horticulturist at the Washington State University Research and Extension Center in Puyallup, Washington, has summarized all of the information on compost tea and the studies that are out there. And her answer is, the stuff you're putting in there, you should just put on the ground. Make compost, not compost tea. And I will just quote her. Look, you're not hurting anything. Although I often look at compost tea setups and go, this is a really hot climate we're in. What else is growing in there? But that's just me. The bottom line, properly composted organic material makes a wonderful mulch. Compost teas have not been suitably characterized, nor have their purported benefits been validated scientifically. Compost teas can be overused and, believe it or not, can potentially even contribute to groundwater pollution. I don't think a homeowner, home gardener is going to get into that. Composted mulch has been documented to suppress disease through a variety of methods. Non-aerated compost teas might be useful in suppressing some pathogens on some plants. There are studies out there that are mixed results. Aerated compost teas have no scientifically documented effect as pathogen suppressors. Okay. So in her opinion, it's better to just take all that stuff that you're putting in and adding water to and steeping, if you will, and just put it on the ground around the plants. In my opinion, it's a lot easier. So I don't think compost tea is worth all the effort. And I think you should just take all that stuff and spread it around your plants. If it seems to be helping, this is one of those things. I learned this particular aphorism from her, although I've paraphrased it. When looking at any product or practice or horticultural recommendation, ask two simple questions. Is it necessary? Is it harmful? If it's necessary, do it. If it's harmful, don't do it. If it's neither necessary nor harmful, fine, go for it. You know, your results may differ, because a lot of what you're going to get, and I anticipate some people out there will send me emails on this, almost everything you see on this is anecdotal. It's, I did this and it seemed to help with that. And I don't believe that compost tea would make any difference whatsoever with reducing the disease on your peach tree. But if there was something in there that had nitrogen and it helped the tree grow a little bit, then that would help the tree outgrow the effect of peach leaf curl. So, but you could take all that same stuff and just put it on the ground under the tree, feeding the soil, feeding the organisms in the soil that make nutrients available to the tree. So I just think it's probably simpler, safer perhaps in some ways, to just use the materials directly on the ground where we do know that they have benefits.
And Mary Kay says that spraying this stuff on the tree, on the leaves of the tree, seemed to help. And I'm wondering if just spraying it with water wouldn't also help it, because the peach leaf curl, once it's there, that leaf is going to curl up and it's going to be replaced by a new leaf, hopefully, if the tree is healthy. So does water do anything on that?
My experience has been that peaches outgrow peach leaf curl. Here in the Sacramento Valley and any place that has a similar climate to ours, you get one primary infection. You might get a secondary or even a third infection, but that's a smaller issue. That's just if it keeps raining like it did in 2024. You might get a secondary infection. But the tree, if it's a healthy peach tree on a good regular rootstock, I'd avoid the dwarfing rootstocks because of this, actually, it will outgrow it. And I've proven this to myself many times by going out when the tree is in full infection. You know, you get a bad year where 80, 90% of the leaves are infected. Set your camera tripod in a particular place, take a picture of a certain frame of foliage, go out a month later, set the camera tripod in the exact same place, take the picture, and you'll notice you probably don't see any leaf curl at this point because the tree has outgrown it. A healthy tree will outgrow peach leaf curl on its own. And so I don't think that the spray has made that difference. But of course, if you want to test this, you got two peaches, spray one, don't spray the other. At least you've got a sample size of n equals two. And you can look at whether you got any kind of results from it. For years, there was a gentleman locally who was recommending a seaweed product to spray on trees to prevent leaf curl or something or other. And finally, a lot of us said, it doesn't do that. That's not a proven benefit. And then his reply was, well, it helps it grow more vigorously. Okay, fine. Well, if you help the tree grow, you'll outgrow peach leaf curl. And a number of the things that she's putting into the compost tea will help the tree. They have nitrogen in them. So nitrogen will help it outgrow leaf curl more quickly than if not. Don't overfeed trees, but keep them healthy, keep them vigorous, and they will outgrow most of the disease problems. It won't make any difference on things like brown rot, the shot hole fungus. There's not proven efficacy of compost teas. And part of it would be isolating all the different things in the compost tea and isolating all the different diseases you're trying to spray and somehow separating all that mishmash of information into a reasonable research project with, you know, blind, with double blind studies and all that kind of stuff. You will find a lot of studies but it's a real mix of outcomes, and they really don't show any particular benefit for going through this process. So I would take all those things that you're using, follow the label direction on them, and apply them directly to the plant on the ground. We know that compost and stuff put on the ground is beneficial. The sprays of compost teas, if it works for you, again, it's not proven, but if that's your anecdote, or you know, I'm talking to others, not the particular writer here, don't stop. It's not harming anything particularly, but it's not necessary. And as far as we can tell, it's not harmful. It's in that gray area of go for it if you want, but don't feel like it's obligatory.
And if anyone out there wants to do an experiment, you need 4 trees. You got one that you're not doing anything to. You got one that you're spraying with the compost tea. You got one that you're spraying with water without the compost tea. And then you've got one that you're mulching with the stuff in the compost.
And they
put the compost tea on the ground, and that would be the same as mulching with it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and they all have to be the same variety on the same rootstock with the same irrigation conditions. So any of you that have 4 O. Henry peaches on level rootstock, they're all irrigated exactly the same. Go ahead and set this up for us. We'd appreciate it. We promise if you do that, we'll report your results. Braden has raised planters in Woodland, California, north of Davis, comparable climate in terms of heat and all that kind of thing. And we were talking about a problem that he was having with tomatoes. And he was concerned that he had a soil disease initially. And I concluded looking at the picture that I didn't think he had verticillium or fusarium, which are the 2 major soil-borne diseases that attack tomato plants. Looked more like a watering problem, a drainage, a just hot summer, difficulty keeping it properly watered, especially in a raised planter. And so I asked for more detail, and we got more detail. So Lois is going to give the first part of it, and we'll talk about each of those aspects to the greatest extent we can.
Okay, the planters are a big wooden box, mostly made from cedar fence boards. It does have a wooden bottom, but with 1-inch holes drilled throughout the bottom, and it sits on 2x4s to give space for the water to run off.
Okay, so that's a really important data point, because when people come in and ask me about raised planters, my first question is there a connection from the soil in the planters to the soil below in your garden? In other words, could roots go out the bottom of this planter and into your native soil? If it is, then that's a raised planter. If it isn't, then it's a giant pot. It's a giant container. And there's a big difference in how we manage containers than how we manage things where the roots can go deeper. If you go online and look up root distribution pictures, you know, where they've actually excavated root systems, you'll find some rather stylized charts, but it always really surprises people to learn that tomato roots can go 4 to 6 feet deep and wide, that the roots of that beet that you just pulled out of the ground were 3 to 4 feet deep. So roots, if they can, will go down through a raised planter and into the soil below. But if you put a zone that they can't get through, then they won't do that, obviously. So now you're growing something in a container rather than growing it in something where they could make use of the native soil. That makes a huge difference. You're growing all of the plants in this box and these planters in a large container.
Okay, he says, I am watering with a drip system on a timer. I water for 20 minutes every morning, though I have been supplementing 10 to 20 minutes in the afternoon during this recent heat wave.
Okay, that's really important right there. The kind of soil you put in is going to make a big difference as to how often you have to water. But bear in mind that any planter, whether it is connected to the soil below or not, is going to drain out faster. Gravity is simply going to drain that water out more quickly. Most people I know who are successful gardeners using raised planters find that at least the first couple of years, when they're using a soil that they put in that drains quickly, they have to water 30 to 35 minutes every day. And he's watering 20 minutes every day and then was doing 10 to 20 minutes more in the afternoon during the recent heat wave. And that's good. That probably made a huge difference. That 30 to 35 minutes could be all at once, or you could split it in 2 like you're doing. And when I tell people this, they're often a little shocked at the plant needing that much water. And I explain, you know, look at our nursery yard. We have hundreds and hundreds of container plants out there. And in extreme heat, we have to water many of them 2 or even 3 times in the same day because their roots are constrained by the containers that they're in. Obviously, early on, you've got lots of soil volume around these roots, but as they grow in and gradually become more root bound and can't explore any further, can't go deeper, can't go wider, they're living on exactly what you're providing them directly, rather than maybe taking advantage of nearby lawn watering or the rose bush over there that you were watering. So 30 to 35 minutes a day has been pretty typical for most people that I know who are using raised planters.
But Don, if you were to water 20, even just 20 minutes in one of those raised planters, the soil is so light and fluffy usually, wouldn't it just run out before the soil would absorb anything?
The soil will absorb it, the water will stay. That gets into the discussion of available water, which is a complicated topic because it depends on the type of soil that was put in. If water is running out the bottom, you might as well stop and then do another cycle a little bit later on the same day. So what you're doing, 20 minutes every morning, then supplementing it 10 to 20 minutes in the afternoon, is probably a good way to hydrate that soil since it's an artificial soil. We'll talk about that as we get further down here. But I think you need to probably keep doing that, irrespective of the heat wave. That's the main thing. One, the plants are bigger, the roots are getting more crowded. Two, it takes more than one hydration typically to hydrate the soil properly. So I would think the way you're doing it now should continue despite the heat wave being past us. You should probably continue to water that way on through August and September. Seems like a lot of water, but it really isn't that much water. It's just that your difficulty is, Lois is alluding, retaining the moisture and having enough available water. If you take potting soils and do this test at home, folks, it's kind of fun. You take a potting soil and you take a gallon of water and you put the pot with soil in it over a bowl and you pour the water into the pot and let it drain through the soil into the bowl and then measure how much water flowed right on through. Okay, out of that gallon, a half gallon of it, or a quarter, or three quarters probably goes right on through, doesn't stick around. And I remember some research out of Australia where they tested something like 25 plus different potting soils. The amount of water they retained varied from 20% of the water applied to 80% of the water applied. The average was about 50%. So a lot of the water you're putting on there is just draining out and not of use to the plants. And so you do have to keep applying it to hydrate the different components of the soil mix that's in there. And you may have to just keep doing it because of the high temperatures, the high ET rates, bearing in mind that a lot of the water you're applying is just draining right through due to gravity. If the roots could go down into the native soil, they would go to where that water goes. But when it's draining out of the pot and draining away, I hope you got a tree nearby that's taking advantage of it because it's not doing the plants in the planter any good. So you don't know exactly how much water is being retained, and that's what we call available water. And soils vary, non-native soils vary wildly as to how much water they actually retain. So that's going to be a big factor in your irrigation management, wherever you're listening. If you brought in soil, it's going to be different than your native soil.
So one of the things that I would be asking, and I think he answers this a little bit later on, is where is he putting the water? In other words, it says 20 minutes. 20 minutes of what?
We'll get
If
to
a
that.
half hour, if it's a half gallon per hour dripper, how many are there in there? So, oh, there it is. Okay. The water was not reaching the edges. Oh, he had 15 bubblers and 8 drip emitters on the line for all of those planters. Water was not reaching the edge of the boxes, so I doubled the bubblers in all the boxes except the one with berry bushes, which have a different soil medium.
Yeah, so we've been talking about the need to go out and check the distribution of your water. And in a raised planter, especially one that doesn't connect through to the soil below, that's extremely important because you may be watering with even whether it's Netafim or bubblers, the soil you brought in tends to drain very fast. It tends to not, there's less capillary action, less lateral spread of water, more just gravity. And so what you end up with very commonly, especially if you buy topsoil from a local rock yard, for example, is a whole series of wet spots. And you can run the system for 30 minutes and you still have just a whole series of wet spots. My friend who moved into town from out in the country and had to garden now exclusively in raised planters found that for a 4 foot wide raised planter, he had to use five lines of drip tubing. So he had emitters every foot down the tubing, but if he put the lines a foot apart, he got four stripes of wet soil. If you put them 8 inches apart, Then the capillary action spread it laterally and the whole zone got moistened. He uses a moisture meter that he purchased. That's Fred Hoffman, who does the Get Growing with Farmer Fred podcast. And he's got information on his website about the moisture meter. You need a higher quality moisture meter, but you can just take a trowel and poke around the next day and you're finding dry spots and wet spots. That's your problem is distribution, as we talked about before. So increasing the bubblers will do it. Using micro sprayers will do it. Adding another line. I had one customer who had put in the Netafim, which is the emitterized tubing where, you know, that's a low output emitter every foot. And he was getting the stripes thing. So he just took one more line and just squiggled it back and forth down the bed, sort of going back and forth across the existing line. That took care of the problem. Another simple way to do it, hand water every now and then. You know, this can make a big difference. Just get a soft rain nozzle that makes a shower of water. Go out there, wash everything off like we want you to do anyway. Water the soil with that. Then turn on your drip system. Then you've already started the capillary movement of water, and the drip system will follow along with that. You won't have a series of wet spots. You'll have a solid wet zone. So again, redundancy in irrigation is a simple technique for avoiding these problems, but you can also find sprayers. There's a million different things you can put on your drip system. Long ago, I had one bed where I knew I was going to be planting greens as we went into October, and it doesn't rain here enough in October. So around the bed, which had drippers in the middle, I put a separate system of micro sprayers. And as we shifted over to the greens, I stopped using the drippers and started using the micro sprayers, which are just little mini sprinklers. And that would water the whole zone. It took a lot longer to water it in, but it covered the whole area. So some combination of different output devices is one thing, or you, with a soft rain nozzle on the end of a hose, can take care of some of these problems. Distribution can be a huge issue.
Don, what's a bubbler? I know what a is, but what's a bubbler?
They're just higher output emitters, basically. But the big advantage of the bubblers, and I've got landscapers who love these, and I use them myself more on trees and shrubs, you can adjust the output. So you can open out at in front of our garden center, the Redwood Barn Nursery. You'll see our whole front is a flower border. It also has shrubs in it and so forth. And there's a lot of these little bubblers out there that you can open them up and they make like a little circle spray. You can tighten them down so they're just more like a drip thing right in the right spot right next to the plant. We use a lot of them out there. They tend to be much higher output. And so you're going to get water coming out the bottom of these planters a lot faster with those bubblers. That doesn't tell you necessarily that you got the distribution, but you can adjust them. So that's one of the key things that we like about those in particular. So scrolling down here to his comments, one of the major factors is what the beds were filled with, obviously. Start of the pandemic, a whole lot of you got into vegetable gardening. And we got a whole lot of calls from people who were building planters in their backyard and who wanted to fill them with bags of stuff. Now, that's an expensive way to go, but I can tell you we were delivering 20, 30, 40 bags of planting mix to people all over the place because they wanted to do vegetable gardening. What Braden did was went to a local rock yard, and I think, here you go.
And he says, I realize that my assessment of my potting soil as being, quote, good quality, unquote, was mostly based on gut feeling about it. It looked and felt nice. I called the rock yard where I bought it, and they said it has the following ingredients. Fir fines, 5/16 lava, forest humus, organic compost, turkey manure, perlite, dolomite, gypsum, and pumice. I added a little compost from the same place, which was made from turkey manure and redwood shavings. I only added fertilizer once or twice.
Yeah, and just so you all know, there's a turkey ranch up in Woodland, which provides aged turkey manure to folks like this particular company that sells bulk amendments. And turkey manure is like chicken manure, a good source of nitrogen. Also, like chicken manure, releases its nitrogen pretty much all in the first growing season. So the first year you do something like this, you're going to get a lot of growth on plants. You will need to supplement that as time goes by. Fir fines and forest humus are just basically shavings and sawdust from lumber mills that have been composted to varying degrees. Organic compost has been fully composted. Lava rock, perlite are added for drainage. Pumice is added for drainage. The more of those, the faster it'll drain, which is great for some things, but it does mean that water will flow through more quickly. And then they've added gypsum and dolomite. Those are to bring the pH to neutral, basically. They don't want it very acidic or very alkaline. So it's a good product. There's a perfectly good combination there. It's going to drain fast. There's coarser bark type materials in there, and there's rock materials in there that enhance drainage. So it is very likely that water will start flowing out the bottom of these planters before the soil is fully hydrated, which means you're going to have to focus, as we've been talking about, on distribution and perhaps augmenting the drippers with overhead spray or hand watering, or just adding more emitters, whatever it takes to get the distribution and take advantage of capillary action. So he's got a couple of questions here, and I'll go through these real quickly. Does the amount of water look like the right ballpark? Yeah. Am I underwatering throughout? Only by distribution. I think the amount of gallons you're putting on is probably fine. The question is whether it's staying in the soil and getting to the plants. So you may have to water more often just because it's not sticking around. A little overhead watering would probably make a big difference. Could the problem be competition from filling the planters so densely? Well, we didn't read all the things you've planted in here, Braden, but you're a lot like me. You're sticking a lot of plants into some of these planters. We'll go back to that. I'm trying to use the vertical space to grow a lot in a small footprint. I also noticed that the box with the most struggling tomatoes has two gigantic cosmos that are a little bit bigger than the tomato vine. Yes, I do this all the time. I have a lot of things in containers, a lot of planters. I use livestock watering troughs. You know, of course, I have a great big vegetable garden out in the ground as well, but I'm testing different plants. I'll just stick things in, and invariably, something outcompetes the other things, and you've got to make a decision at some point. If those cosmos are outgrowing your tomato vine, you better decide which one you prefer, because I guarantee whatever one is getting bigger, and members of the daisy family, cosmos, sunflowers, things like that can be surprisingly aggressive, is going to win. And I don't mind if that happens, but if tomatoes were more important to you, you might keep that in mind. The issue there becomes they're root bound. The roots are competing, and you're just not going to get the robust growth that you're hoping for on your tomato plant as long as you got something else in there that's out-competing it. If I add worm castings, which I've talked about, how much should I add per box? Should I also be fertilizing more regularly? I don't think you need to fertilize with all that turkey manure in there. And good news, if you do use worm castings, they contain about 3% nitrogen as well. They're comparable to chicken and turkey manure. They don't claim it on the label because it's variable, but that's been what I've seen when they've been analyzed, typically 2 to 3% nitrogen. Worm castings are kind of dirt. They're soil. And the reason I like people to use them in raised planters, at least in small amounts, is they're a finer texture, so they will retain moisture and they'll retain nutrients. They're also rather expensive. So what I usually suggest is buy yourself one bag of them and just start sprinkling them a cup, half a cup to a cup at a time around the plants that are struggling. And they'll help, like in that little root zone, get a little more moisture, and they'll add a little bit of nitrogen. So while you could go out and buy a whole bunch of worm castings at a very high price, a better bet is to just go ahead and use them where you seem to need them, because they will help you retain moisture. And as we've said many times talking about raised planters, whether they're connected through to the soil or not, over time, you can make them work better by growing things in them that have root systems that you then cut the top off and let the roots decompose. You know, you're adding organic material when you do that, by top dressing with any good quality compost. Doesn't matter whether it has nutrients in it, just whatever you like that you find at your local garden center that they have in a larger unit, the compressed bales typically. Put a couple inches on the surface. Arborist wood chips are fine if you just want to shade the soil and retain moisture, but compost will have the advantage usually of adding some nutrients and breaking down more quickly and enhancing the soil that way. If you've got them connected through to the soil below, worms will start coming up and going down and coming up and going down and helping to make that connection better for the roots. In the long run, your best bet is to set these things on the ground so the roots can get through to the soil below. But if you can't do that, you can build the soil by increasing the density with things like worm castings and also adding more organic material each season. And we have two gardening seasons here, each fall and each spring, top dressing with an inch or two of whatever compost you like to just help enhance the soil that way. And you're adding all these things that have nitrogen in them, so be careful about over-fertilizing. You shouldn't really need to add any liquid fertilizer in the case of what you're doing here, because you've already got turkey manure, you're already talking about worm castings and so forth. Go by the plant performance in terms of nitrogen needs. There are lots of ways you can provide nitrogen that's sort of steady and gentle through the season without going to one of the liquid soluble type products that you find at so many garden centers. I prefer to just use whatever organic slow-acting nitrogen source I have at the time of planting. Then I'll side dress plants that might need a little supplemental feeding usually about now, early to mid-August, seems to be a very good time to side dress your peppers, your eggplant, tomatoes that aren't performing as well. Just get any good tomato vegetable food or something like that and go ahead and do a little feeding if they appear to need it. Don't do it automatically necessarily.
Now, the next one is, this is one that Kimberly wrote a long time ago, and it's about tree irrigation. I see this ring installed on many young trees, and then there's no additional irrigation specifically for the tree. I think it's a poor design because it's usually so close to the base of the tree, and the more productive location for water uptake tends to be near or beyond the canopy, encouraging roots to grow where the water is out wide. I like the idea of the ring or rings, but what do you think? Where does a young tree need water most? Should the smallest ring be a certain distance away from the trunk? I know the 50% beyond the canopy might be a good location for the largest ring. Anyway, this is what I see so often, and it seems wrong to me, even though it reminds me of agriculture and berms.
Yeah, it's actually sort of comes to us from orchard practices. A single ring of drip around a tree is better than nothing, but it's not optimal. The reason I wanted to bring this up for this program is that right now, August, September into early October is a really important time to deep irrigate the woody plants in your yard, particularly the trees, especially the young to medium age trees that aren't 60 years old and have their roots places you can't even imagine. And back during the first of the two major droughts we went through, Lauren Oakey, cooperative extension researcher here at UC Davis, who's just retired, but he published a method for irrigating trees that you can find pretty easily. And I wanted to give you the search term, tree ring irrigation contraption, T-R-I-C, tree ring irrigation contraption. If you do a Google search for that and throw in UCANR if you want to, you'll find it. And you'll find an illustration of how to do this. What it basically is, he was recommending, this is particularly for trees in lawns where people were killing their lawns and thus inadvertently often killing their trees. In that instance, you would put one ring fairly close to the trunk, one ring out close to the drip line, and one ring out past the drip line. And then the key is to run it long enough to irrigate to a depth of at least 18 inches. You can read far more detail about it, but that's the idea. And to irrigate to a depth of at least 18 inches, you're going to run that thing typically for a couple of hours, if not more. So you would have at least three rings. If you run it long enough, you know, capillary action may bring that moist area together and wet the whole zone, but at least you'd be irrigating a significant percentage of the root zone of the plant, of the tree or shrub, large shrub, if you irrigate in those three zones. TRIC, tree ring irrigation contraption. You'll find a blog article about it at ucanr.edu, or you can just find the entire description by looking up tree ring irrigation contraption at the California Center for Urban Horticulture.
So today I want to close with a quote from Audrey Hepburn, and she says, "To plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow."
Okay. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.